Welcome to So You Want to Be a Copywriter, brought to you by the Australian Writers Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses. Your host is Bernadette Schwert, who you'll find at copyschool.com, and you can find out more about all our copywriting courses at copywritingcourses.com.au. Now, over to Bernadette.
Would you like to land a copywriting job in an advertising agency working with blue chip clients? How about working in New York, in the heart of advertising land? What about using your copywriting skills to write a best-selling novel? Well, if you'd like to learn how to do any of these, then you need to listen to Philip Tafs. Philip has worked as a senior writer and creative director in both Melbourne and Manhattan. He's worked with major players like Menulog and PlayStation, and he helped launch the Honda CR-V and Odyssey cars into Australia. He's taught copywriting at Award School, strategic communications at La Trobe University, public relations at Deakin University, and advertising, media and social at Swinburne. His best-selling novel, Bubby, was recently re-released into the United States to great acclaim. In this podcast, you'll hear how he did it all and get some important lessons on how you can get your foot in the door to launch your copywriting career, even if you don't have any experience. Hello, I'm Bernadette Schwert. I'm the founder of the Australian School of Copywriting and the head copywriting tutor at the Australian Writers Centre. I got my start in a big advertising agency, and it set me up for a great career as a freelancer. So how do you get your foot in the door of these big agencies? Well, in short, you do good work and you show it to as many people as you can. If you'd like to learn how to kickstart your creative copywriting life, why not enroll in Copywriting Essentials and learn how to write both conceptual and direct response so you can find work in a range of different agencies? After all, a short course can make a big impact. Just ask Sol Allen. He said about the courses he enrolled with us, "I was an actor but needed to get a side hustle to keep going. I did your course, loved it, created my own speculative portfolio, got an internship in a creative ad agency, and within a few months have become a full-time member of their creative team. Without your course, I would never have known how to get my foot in the door. I love it so much now I gave up acting. I've found what I want to do and I can't think of anything I'd rather do." Well, excellent work, Sol. If you'd like to learn more, why not visit writerscentre.com.au/essentials or copyschool.com. And if you like our podcasts, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Let's get started. Philip, how are you? Thank you for joining me.
Thanks very much, Bernadette. I've heard a lot about you and took the time to listen to one of your earlier interviews with Ben Keenan. And I thought my head was going to nod off because I just kept nodding along with everything that he said. So that demonstrates to me, which I already knew, and he already knows, that, you know, the copywriters, good copywriters, know what works, and we've been trained properly, and we understand advertising. And he just seemed like, I've never met him, but he already seemed like a mate.
Yeah, he's a really interesting man. He started off as one of my students back in the day. He was just at RMIT doing music and video editing and a whole bunch of other interesting things. And he found the bug. And after the course, he, you know, got a contact and went to Award School, and the rest is history. You know, he's the creative director of major agency. So I'm super proud of Ben, and he's done an amazing job. And sounds like you've had an unbelievable career too, not just in Australia, but around the world, and particularly New York. So I will be talking to you about those experiences. But what I want to kick off with, Philip, is your novel, because a lot of copywriters want to write a novel. And yeah, I'm interested as to, firstly, tell us a bit about Bubby. How did that come about and what it's about?
Okay, so I'm not sure if you or the listeners know Kate Langbrook. She's been on TV, been on radio, sort of, you know, media personality, but she was a close friend of mine in the 90s, and we ended up going to this psychic in Carlton, of all places, and he was doing a national tour, so he was not a down and dirty psychic. He was kind of the real deal, as much as psychics can be the real deal. So he'd done Brisbane, he'd done Sydney, he'd come down to Melbourne, and he'd been written up in Vogue magazine, again, of all places. And he just walked into the room, and he was sort of like a barefoot hippie from Brisbane. And he just started talking at me, like he didn't even say hello. He just started talking at me, like looking at me like I was a TV screen. And one of the first things he said was, you're with your writer. I didn't say one thing to him during the whole session. And he didn't ask me one question. He just told me my life, basically. He said, with your writing and you're going to go to New York and you're going to write this Stephen King type book and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And at that time I came from like a straight, you know, English at uni background. I probably looked down my nose a little bit at Stephen King then, not now, but then, seen the movies, seen Carrie and, you know, The Shining, et cetera. And I was thinking, how am I going to get to New York? I'm working for a small agency in Port Melbourne. We're not part of a multinational or whatever. Anyway, 3 years later, there I was in New York, living in this shabby, spooky hotel straight out of The Shining, just a spit down from the Dakota where, you know, John Lennon was murdered, and we used to see Yoko walking in the street and Lauren Bacall because she was also a resident. And we had some we had a bit of a family mishap there. I won't go into much more detail than that. We had a bit of a family mishap, but that provided the emotional and the psychic fuel for an idea for the novel, which eventually became Bubby.
Wow. And do you still think psychics work? Have you been back?
Yeah. So the book's actually dedicated to him. His name's Alan Pilkington. He's gone now. He passed. But the next time, when I came back to Australia, I did see him again because I'd started writing Bubby by then. I was thinking, this guy's the real deal. He knows stuff about me. And I walked into the room and again sat down. He didn't even say hello. Like he wouldn't. Skeptical people say psychics have like teams of researchers in the next room, and like, no, it wouldn't be worth their while, right? Some people just have a gift. He had the gift. It was even before internet days, really. You couldn't find out much about me from the internet back then. And I sat down, he said, oh, you know, you're going back to America. So he knew that I'd been to America without me saying anything. So, and then he knew that my son was called Louis, and, you know, he just knew stuff. So I ended up seeing him a number of times over the years. And, he was like a beacon for me. So he told me I was going to write this book, and that was a thing that really, really kept me going. And that's my advice to other writers. Just you can't ever give up. You just got to keep going and going and going.
Yeah, that stamina is such a – it's a learnt skill in some respects. Some people have it naturally. Others have to learn it. Others just have to dig deep. And I'm interested about the copywriting and the novel writing. Is there any overlap? And if so, what is it?
There is a definite overlap. And I know that many copywriters have novels sitting in their bottom drawer, but that's not where they should be. They shouldn't be in your bottom drawer. They should be on your desk, and you should be working on it in between briefs. I wrote a lot of Bubby at CHE Advertising. I wrote a bit of it at Magnum Opus Advertising. It didn't mean that I was sort of writing at the company's expense, but, you know, when you're a copywriter, there's downtime where you're waiting for account service or the client to get back to you. So just have it there in your desk and work on it. There were many weekends where my family went away and holidays where they went away, and sometimes I didn't. I just stayed home and I worked. So you just have to put the work, and you have to treat it like a work project, not like a little sort of dabbling thing.
What about the craft side of things? What kind of techniques and habits, I guess, did you find common from copywriting to novel writing?
Okay, so to answer your first question, I kind of deviated a little bit. It helps. Copywriting certainly makes you faster, I think. You learn how to craft sentences better, straight up, and also more quickly. It also helps you with editing, self-editing. But apart from that, I was thinking about it. There aren't as many similarities as you would imagine, because an ad is one idea, or it should be. It should be one powerful, single-minded idea, whereas a novel is like a gazillion interconnected ideas that add up to hopefully an engaging whole. And also, obviously, with the book, there should be some kind of subtext, some kind of layer of emotion or psychology or something that's beyond words. So if you're a copywriter, then you also need to have that kind of will and thinking and approach. It's not just the words. It's more than just the words.
Do you find that as a copywriter, you're less attached to your words? Like you're quite prepared to ditch things quite quickly?
Yeah.
That's the nature of what we do. Do you find that comes into your noveling as well?
Yeah. So you know, kill your darlings. Yeah, you're much better at that than the average person, perhaps. But another weird thing I discovered, and it's a bit precious for me to be talking like I'm some sort of expert at writing novels. I've only had one published so far. There's another one out with publishers at the moment, based on the re-release I had recently. But what I learned is that you shouldn't. The main thing is not to treat it like a marathon and not try to write a story from go to woe, because it's too hard. You'll get, you know. So what I learned was, if you can write individual chapters and have them as sort of like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, you might end up moving chapter 9 to chapter 2 and make it like a flashback, or, you know, and just have all of the pieces there that you can play around with. It certainly helped me if you're writing a thriller to know what the ending is. In fact, I think you kind of need to know what the ending is if you're writing a thriller, and that gives you a finish line to write up to. But as any writer will tell you, if you get some good characters, interesting characters, the characters take over and they end up doing things that surprise you, and it's a journey of discovery. And one similarity with copywriting is when you do, as you'll know from your agency experience, when you put all the work on the walls and then you go home for the night at, you know, 2 a.m., give it the overnight test, and then you come back the next morning and you keep the good work and pull all the rest of the dross down. Same thing happens with writing a novel. Stephen King calls them the guys in the basement. So while you're asleep, your subconscious is working on stuff, and you come back to your work the next day and go, actually, that doesn't work, but I had a dream and that connects better with that, et cetera, et cetera. So your subconscious has a huge part to play in the development. You just have to trust it and follow it. Another thing is, I'm reading Graham Greene at the moment, The End of the Affair. Very fine writer, fine craftsman. He did 500 words a day, and many writers have a daily habit of doing a certain number of words. And another good thing for copywriters is, when there's a global financial crisis and all of your clients disappear and there's no work, so that's when you work on your book. And I was trying to do at least 500 words a day then. So just treat it like a real job. Don't wait. Like I jokingly said to you, you know, one bit of advice is to start 20 years ago, because it takes a while. It takes a certain amount of time to write the book, but then to sell it, to find an agent and a publisher, is just pure, pure slog. And unless you're incredibly lucky, it takes a long time. So it took me 5 years to write Bubby, and then at least 7 years to get agents and publishers and finally sell it.
What was so difficult about that process of selling it? What took 7 years? Was it just sending it out and getting no? What was that journey like?
It's like pitching. You've got to pitch a novel like you pitch an ad. You've got to write a compelling query. You've got to research your market and let potential agents and publishers know what your book is like. My book is like this thriller by, you know, Leanne Moriarty, for example. But it's also different. You don't want to say it's exactly the same as another writer's, but you need to find your little toehold, your territory, if you like. And you need to find agents that are interested in that kind of book. So you wouldn't send a thriller, quite a dark thriller, to an agent that handles, you know, romantic, dramatic books. Okay. So you need to do that kind of research as well. And then sometimes you get really close to the finish line. I had this a couple of times in Australia where they say, oh, look, we really like your book, but we've got this other book coming out that's quite similar and that's sort of ahead of yours. So sorry, come back next time. It's just, I know. So with Bubby, I ended up pitching to 70 publishers in Australia, England, and the United States, and I ended up having four agents, and I rewrote it about 10 times as well. And in the end, I ended up selling it myself to a publisher in London, but then I got my American agent back on board and he got me a better advance.
And what's your advice for copywriters who might be wanting to do a novel, just from that business perspective? Should they think globally first, like it seems you did, or stick to Australian publishers? What's your advice there?
Well, agents and publishers will tell you to sort of be to be niche and formulaic about it, that's fine if you sell your book within like maybe the first dozen pitches that you do. Like J.K. Rowling, she did 12, I think, to get the first Harry Potter sold. But if you don't sell them the first 12, what do you do then? So to me, if you don't have an early sale, then it becomes a numbers game. And it's a matter of timing and application. So in the end, Bubby hit my editor in London's desk just at exactly the right time. He must have had a clean slate that day, picked it up, read it, engaged with it, gave it to his boss. His boss read it, and I heard back within 2 weeks. And that's often the way when you finally get the right, you know, stars aligning, that's what happens. So Tanya Farrelly, who I work with at Mojo, she was strategist at Mojo. She's had some novels published recently, and the same thing happened to her. I read an interview with her the other day, and it took her 17 days only to hear back from the publisher. So when it clicks, it clicks.
What was that feeling like when you got word that it's going ahead?
Oh, I cried. I cried. It had been so long. You know, it had been like 12 years. I was exhausted, and yeah, I was down at Summers, actually, seaside town, by myself working on my next book. It was just so fulfilling, and it was just awesome.
What kept you going, Philip?
Well, the psychic was part of it. The psychic said, you know, you're going to publish a Stephen King type book. And he'd been right about everything else. So I thought, Alan said it's going to happen. And then he also said it's going to be turned into a movie. That hasn't happened yet, but my agent does deal in film. So he's always putting it out there. So who knows, maybe it'll be a movie one day as well.
I hope so. And we will get on to copywriting because you've had a stellar career, but I'm still just want to just cover off a few things about the novel writing.
Sure.
What would you do differently with this book if you had your time again?
Well, it's just been re-released in the States, and Bubby is a new title, and it also has a new cover. So the original title I never liked. I won't say what it was. I didn't like the publisher chose it, and because I was a newbie publisher, you don't really have that much power. They said, oh, no, this is going to be the title and this is the cover. But I thought it was pitched too much into traditional horror, whereas mine is hopefully more psychological horror, so more Rosemary's Baby, where you're not quite sure whether it's real or not. So I would have fought much harder to have a different title and different cover. As to what else I would have done differently, I would have started earlier. I would have, yeah, if you're a young copywriter now in your 20s, start now. I mean, I started off writing short stories and had a few of those published and, you know, did okay in a couple of competitions, which sort of gave me the feeling, oh, maybe there is a future in this. And then I gradually graduated to novels. But start early because it can take so long.
Excellent. Let's move on to your advertising career. It's been quite extraordinary. Maybe just talk me through some of the highlights of your career that's really stuck with you.
Okay. Well, sort of embarrassingly, I suppose the ad that I'm best known for was one of the probably the first TV ad that I was involved with, which was for SunSmart here in Victoria. And it wasn't just me and my team, my art director, Matt Burgess, and my suit, Graham Sanford. We came up with a campaign based on Leave Your Hat On, the song, and also 9 and a Half Weeks, the film. So if you remember in the film with Mickey Rourke and Kim Basinger, they take their clothes off to the tune of You Can Leave Your Hat On, sung by Randy Newman. So for our SunSmart message, we reversed that and had a couple putting their clothes on, getting ready for the sun, and finally the girl puts the hat on the guy, and then, you know, the lyric finishes, you know, leave your hat on. And that, it's not the most creative ad in the world, but because it had a great soundtrack and a, you know, an idea that everybody could kind of relate to, it worked really well. And, you know, they did all the stats and all the research, and apparently it had great traction, and Leave Your Hat On kind of went into the vernacular a little bit. Randy Newman was great in terms of coming to the party. He charged only $50,000 to use the song. And then, you know, Wendy Stapleton, one of Australia's great singers, she did an awesome job singing it. So that was definitely a highlight and a great way to kick off. Another thing that I'm proud to be involved with, again, it wasn't just me, it was the team, was helping to introduce the Honda CR-V and the Honda Odyssey into Australia from Japan. That was certainly monumental. I was saying to my advertising class last night at Swinburne that, you know, most people have no idea how much work goes into getting an ad to air or even a billboard up on the up by the side of the there's so much work that goes in before you see the final product. And so when we launched those two Hondas, that was a good 6 months work, virtually 24/7, team of us doing it. And again, that was very well received by the client. Honda were a wonderful client to work with. We had fabulous people in their marketing department. Very much was a team effort.
You teach copywriting and marketing and branding. What are some of the principles that you teach your students that you think is absolutely integral to being a successful copywriter?
One thing I say, and this is maybe a little bit controversial today, given I have a 17-year-old, and I know that his generation, they're not big readers, much as you try to encourage them. I still maintain that you need to be a great reader to be a good writer, or else who's going to look after the words? Who's going to be the custodian of the words and make sure that they're spelt correctly, they're in the right order, that the syntax sings? You need to be a craftsman with words, and you can't possibly be that without being a reader. You can have great ideas. I'm not saying you can't have great ideas, but I had an experience when I worked at Mojo, and this groovy young team came in. I think they might have been from Sydney. And they came in and they sort of, they're sort of leaning on each other, slouching around. And I said, so who's the writer and who's the art director? And they said, oh, well, we don't really like labels. We don't, sometimes I do the headline and sometimes, she does the words. We don't really think like that. And I said, okay, well, who's going to write this 30-page Telstra brochure? And you know who ended up writing it? Me. Because there wasn't really a writer there. There are ideas people, and that's fine, but you still need people who can write. And I don't think that AI has yet supplanted that. I mean, I've done a few little experiments with AI, and I'm not, yes, it serves a purpose, might be helpful for some very rudimentary research, but even some basic research I got to do on box office of films, it was actually wrong and inaccurate, and it kept apologizing to me. It's like, well, this is actually wasting time, not saving time. I'm yet to read any amazingly crafted copy that's been created by AI that's actually on brief and meeting the brief.
So, Philip, if you had a role for a copywriter in your agency, let's just say, what could they do to get noticed by you if they wanted a job as a copywriter in an advertising agency?
Okay, so I'm still a big believer in what I call real world. So I still hand out business cards, which might be seen as being, old hat, but they work because not everybody does it anymore. And I can't tell you how many times I've been at a cafe, got into a conversation with somebody, or met a new client for a drink or a coffee, and then handed them a card. And the card should, if you're copywriting, the card should have a creative idea attached to it, right? Not just say, Joe Smith, copywriter. But if the car can act like a mini little ad or campaign for you, and like I've done a series of five of them over the years, so it is like a campaign. My positioning, what I call a creative positioning statement, what most consumers call a slogan. My slogan is quite good at making things up. So I've done five different business cards over the years with that as kind of the creative idea behind it. If you're a copywriter, show me something in the real world that's different. I hired a young woman a few years ago called Michelle Withers when she was just starting out, and we had the meeting, whatever, and she handed me a business card, which I wasn't expecting. It just said dial in for Michelle, which it just made me laugh. And she ended up being creative director at Leo Burnett. I think, based on what I've said before, you would probably need to be a reader to sort of get me interested in you. You would need to be able to, you need to show me your work. So often people come and say, I want to get a job, but they actually don't have like even a folio. Or they show things that don't demonstrate what they're actually capable of. You just have to obviously stand out and be different. I mean, sometimes there's a personality sink. There might be something about their personality. You might not see it yet on the page, but you can just tell that they're capable of doing it. It's kind of it's an inexact thing. I can't really put my finger on it, but yeah.
I believe too, and this has been reinforced of late, that it's nice to present yourself as a whole person, not just about the business and what you can do. It's like bring in your hobbies, your passions, your interests. And the example I use, I guess, is I recently became a yoga teacher, not because I want to teach yoga, but I just love yoga and I wanted to be better at it. But it's been an absolutely joyful process and I've learned a lot. And every now and then, if the occasion calls for it, I bring it up. And one of the clients I've just finished working with, which is a very well-known businessman who's very into meditation and mindfulness, which I didn't really know when I first met him. And I just threw in the bit about yoga. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure if I should, because it feels a little bit off-brand. It feels a little bit distracting. You know, that's like split focus or something. Anyway, he picked up on it very quickly and he said, well, I am, well, you know, not I am, but I do it too. I've just been to a yoga retreat in Bali. I meditate all the time, you know, and it was like we had this shared understanding. And he said later that it was because of those shared values. That was one of the reasons he picked me as his ghostwriter. It wasn't the only reason, but it showed a little bit more of a depth, I guess, of connection between the two of us, that we think about the same things.
Yeah.
So I guess when I talk to my students, I always try and, you know, they might have done something quite interesting in another life, or they've got a really interesting hobby, or not even interesting, but just a hobby. It might be craft, you know, it might be knitting, it might be mechanics.
Yeah.
Bring it in, talk it up, you know, because it's a connection point.
Yeah. Also think of, obviously, personality. Like if you have someone who's sort of arrogant, and you can just tell that they're going to be hard to get along with, that's also a bit of a red flag, because you're going to be spending a lot of time with this person, and you can't have a situation where your working life day to day is not enjoyable. I'm not saying everybody has to be happy go lucky and you know, backslapping and, you know, smiling all the time. Of course, there's a lot of stress involved in working in that agency. But if somebody's personality is going to be a downer or difficult all the time, then that's not going to be, it's not going to be great for the team or the environment.
I agree. One of the things I found when I was, you know, hiring people, but also when I was pitching for things and I was told back, it was like, be enthusiastic, you know, really demonstrate your passion for this, that you want it. Don't be too cool for school, where, you know, the sense of enthusiasm is seen as a little bit passé, you know. So I always try and let my students know that if you want something, tell them that you really want it, that you're really excited, that this would make a big difference to you. Because it's, I think nobody wants someone around who's, it doesn't look like they want it, you know. It feels like you're doing them a favour, or they're doing you a favour by working for you.
That's right. Having a beard doesn't make you creative.
Having a beard.
Yeah. You need more than that. You need a brain as well.
You need socks too. I like
That's
socks.
Right.
That's another story. I'm just a bit old school like that. Let's talk about portfolios, because you just mentioned if you want to get a job, you should have a portfolio. Now, I'm in two schools of thought with this one. One is for an agency, absolutely, because, you know, that's what you're doing. But I've had a lot of students who just want to do freelance and they have got nothing to show. So firstly, I'd say do try and create something. But if you haven't, don't let that stop you, because often people will hire you based on you, your personality, how you present, how you pitch in that moment. And they're just like, I just want it done. I don't really care what you've done. But let's say you do need a portfolio to get a job with you. What can people do if they haven't got a job to get a portfolio, the chicken and the egg scenario?
Okay, so the old school approach, which I think still works, is get the Australian Women's Weekly, and because that's filled with product and services. Choose some ads, maybe from major clients, well-known clients, but who haven't done a very good job, haven't done a very good ad, and do a better ad. So you're going to get like at least 10 ads out of the Women's Weekly, where you can show the original ad and say, here's what I've done, which is different and hopefully better. An even more powerful thing to do, which I haven't actually done, but I was lucky enough to meet a man called John Turnbull, who was creative director at the Campaign Palace years ago. And he said, get the morning paper, The Age or the Herald Sun. Again, look at the ads in that paper, do better ads that morning, and then go and have a meeting with the creative director that afternoon. Because that shows you can think, you know, creatively and also quickly, work under pressure.
What do you say in terms of getting in touch with people? You know, how would a young copywriter, or not even young, just a novice copywriter, get in touch with someone like that? What's the best modus operandi?
So never call them. Even back in the day, don't call them, because if you're a creative director, you're always absurdly busy, unless you're secretly working on your novel. you have to be creative in your approach. You have to hustle, not hassle. So I used to do things like, there's an agency in Melbourne back in the day, a very good creative agency called Thompson White. And on Sunday night, I was lucky at that time to be with someone who was an art director. on Sunday night, I'd do some scamps, or she'd do some scamps for me, and I would drive down to Thompson White in South Melbourne and slip the ads under the door, literally four or five ads for, Electrolux or Bosch or whatever, so that Stephen Fisher, who is the creative director, would find them on Monday morning. And then another time, I was trying to get a job on a car account, so I went to an auto wrecker and I got things like a rear view mirror and a steering wheel and a gear stick, and I got little tags, and I wrote little messages and attached them to the steering wheel, like, needs, they're probably bad puns looking back on it, but, say, is the account steering in the right direction? To the gear stick, I said, you need, someone to help the account go a bit faster, or, what I mean? Just it was, but it was the object itself that garnered attention. So the creative director arrived at the agency, and there, sitting on his desk, was a steering wheel with this message attached. So he said to me, "Oh, you've got my attention," and that's what good copywriting has to do. That's what good advertising has to do. I haven't bothered him. I've made him smile, and so that kind of thing works. You're never going to bore somebody into giving you a job, are you?
I reminded me of a time when I was quite young. I was trying to get a job on TV, and I sent Channel 9 my showreel, like the managing director, whoever it was. And it was like in the big, VHS cassette things. I put it in this massive envelope and I doled it up with like wrapping paper and bows and made it look quite pretty. And I genuinely just wanted it to look pretty, right? And he got it and he opened it and he said, "I was really excited to get it, and then I was a little bit disappointed when I saw it was inside it." This was just my showreel. But the point was, he noticed it, he opened it. It's all you can do, isn't it? The packaging's just got to
Right.
get open. The copy's got to get read.
Yeah, and then you I suppose you could follow up with the phone call in that situation, but don't, just don't hassle people, and only you can be the monitor of that.
And I'll go a bit deeper on this one, Philip, because I think a lot of people listening will think, well, no one works in an office anymore. Like, what do you
No,
do
that's true.
if, that might be a difficult question without notice, but how can you network with people like this or get in touch with them if no one's got an office anymore?
That is difficult. If you, and it's also hard because of, I suppose, privacy issues now as well. I don't know, like even like a beautifully written letter that arrives through the mail is going to have much more impact than an email, because emails are just so disposable. We all, I mean, years ago when I was doing new business, and if you want to be a freelance copywriter, you have to be half creative, half business. So I used to sit down for 2 days, and I'd have like a thousand people on my database, and I would literally, like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, write the same message over and over again, with some hopefully clever headline, and then, "Hello, I'm Philip Tafs, I'm a copywriter, blah blah blah. Do you want to see my folio?" And I'd send out maybe 1,000, maybe it was 750 emails over the 2 days, and you would almost always get, I don't know, 20 responses, and then you get five meetings, and then you get two jobs. It's the old Saatchi and Saatchi method, where back in the day, they would make phone calls. They make 100 phone calls, get 20 meetings, get on five pitches, and win two accounts. But to win the two accounts, you've got to make the 100 phone calls. So I don't know. Just think about what everyone else would do and then do something different. Like, I'm a big fan of Simon Reynolds, who, of course, did Grim Reaper, and he's not in advertising anymore. But some of his print work, back in the day, it was just incredible, even better than Grim Reaper, which was TV. But he wrote a book called "When They Zig, You, When They Zig, Zag." So do the opposite.
Yeah, I love that book. I also think personal connections are important, and I'm a people person on some level. I like my own time too, but when needed, I like conferences, I like events, I like things where people are going to be there. I think that's a fast way of building a connection, is look for industry events where you think these creative directors and copywriters and art directors are going to be. Do you do that?
Yes, when you can, when it's appropriate. And again, though, you kind of have to be, what's the word? You have to be a good, you have to have a good feel for human nature, I think. And you have to have a feel for whether your conversation is actually going well and the other person's finding you interesting. If you have a good conversation, then you say, "Oh, would you like my card?" rather than meet them for the first second and say, "Oh, here's my card." You know what I mean? You have to be sort of sensible about it as a human. But yeah, if you do, I always say, if you do something, something will happen, and you've got to get out and, you know, not get out and be seen and be seen-y and go to, you know, every industry event. But that's when you're not going to get a job sitting at home in your room. Okay. Yeah. You still need to beat the drum in real life.
And I think, you know, that sense of it's like repetition, like any kind of ad, it's got to have, you know, a number of touch points. It's a bit the same. If you meet someone once, it's nice. You don't do the big pitch, but you maybe, you know, connect with them on LinkedIn or you find some common ground and then you might see them again at something else. But I think the drip method is powerful as well. Like, I remember my first job in advertising. I was at uni and the lecturer ran Young and Rubicam in Adelaide, and I was at him for a job from the get-go. He was only in there once and, you know, for one session. He said, look, we don't, believe it or not, take women because our client is of a certain country and they don't work with women. So, oh, well, that's interesting. Thanks for that. And next year he came back. I said, I'm back. Can I have a job? He says, you haven't got any experience. He was trying to find excuses not to give me a job. He says, you've got no experience, you know, keep coming back. You know, so in the third year, he said, look, still no issues. We've still got the same clients. They still don't want to work with women. So, you know, anyway, long story short, 2 years later, I went to work in America, got all this other experience, and I still contacted him. I said, look, I'm coming back to Australia for a wedding. If there's anything in your office right now, any low-level job, consider me. And the next day, I went into my office and there was a fax. This is how old it was. There was a fax on my desk with Y&R letterhead, you know, such an iconic kind of brand.
Yes, yes.
And there was his letter to me saying, Bernadette, when you come back to Australia, give me a hoy.
Fabulous.
We got a job. And I went for the interview. I got it. So that was like a 5-year campaign.
Yes, that's right.
And it was life-changing. That was like my dream job. So I guess what I'm saying is people have the vision, you know, don't just think rejection is the story for the future.
No is just another step to yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Never give up.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about Y&R? Because I know that you worked there. So you started an account service and then jumped the fence into creative? Is that
I was account service.
Unusual thing to do.
Yeah, and I never really perceived myself as creative. Or certainly not a copywriter. It was, you know, in those days, the boundaries were really strong and it was quite presumptuous to think that as an account service person, you could become a copywriter. But anyway, and I didn't really even think about being a copywriter in those early days. It was only when I left and I went to work for Harry Miller in publicity and celebrity stuff, and then I went back to the agency as a freelancer, then I started just doing little things for them. You know, they said, look, we've got Apple account. Can you go and do these interviews with all these people who use Apple? Like, yeah. And so I started writing copy and it was almost organic. Yeah. And that's kind of where it began. So I had to get my head in the game though. I remember saying to a friend of mine who was a small agency owner, he did everything. I said, well, how do I become a copy? I said, well, you already are. You're already writing copy. You're already fixing it. You're already writing the briefs. You're already, you know, going out and interviewing and doing all sorts of stuff. So you just believe that you anoint yourself as the copywriter. And that was a really good turning point for me to think no one's going to come and say, oh, you are now a copywriter.
Yes.
You know, you have to give yourself permission. And from there, I just said, well, that if he can do it, I can do it. And that's kind of how it began.
So you'd got in through stealth, which is great, which is clever. It's like I said to my students, just to your point, just get in the door. Don't worry what the job is. Once you're in the door, you've got over the castle walls. You're in the city now. You're safe. You can then strategize. You can make allegiances. You can prove your mettle by doing great work, and you'll slowly rise.
Yeah, you've got to get in the door. Don't be too proud. It's got to be this role at this level at this pay. Just take it, whatever you can get.
That's right.
Let's talk about your New York experience, because I think anyone would agree that New York is the, you know, the home of advertising. What job did you do there?
Well, I had a friend called Shoba from university, and she'd gone over to London years prior to that and set up this sort of international public relations company called Bulletin. So they had offices in London and Singapore. And she'd moved to New York to set up the New York office for her PR company. And it was during the dot-com boom. And, you know, it was like the Wild West. Like, it was just, there were parties every night, all of these companies with no actual business idea, just with a groovy name, we're getting funded. It was crazy. She said, Philip, you've got to come over here. I want you to set up like a little advertising consultancy underneath our public relations umbrella. So I went over and set up this consultancy that I called MI5. And I worked with this guy called Rana Dasgupta, who at that time was kind of like the boring accounts guy, but he ended up jumping ship and becoming a fabulous writer, much better than me. And he's ended up winning the Commonwealth Writers Prize for fiction. But we worked together as kind of like a dynamic duo during the dot-com boom in New York. We worked on 8th Avenue and 6th Avenue, and the first 6 months were fabulous, but then the bubble burst. And then I could see Shob was firing people sort of on a daily, almost a daily basis. Now, I wasn't fired yet because I was their friend, but I could see the writing on the wall. So I took my folio to BBDO and they said, oh, you know, we really like your folio, particularly because it's different because it was Australian. So I had to kind of sort of, I don't know what Australian meant, but, you know, obviously I was showing them different stuff. They said, look, we'd hire you, but we've just let, you know, 200 people go yesterday. So that's why we came back to Melbourne after exactly a year. But, you know, at least I got the idea for the novel.
And in terms of the writing differences, I'm quite curious. I mean, people often say, well, is there a difference between Australian copywriting and American copywriting? Did you find there was a different requirement?
Well, if you go back to, I don't know whether people go back through award annuals so much anymore. But if you look at, you know, classic American ads, there's a smartness, kind of a, not smart ass, not smart alecky, but a smartness, a quickness, you know, a confidence. Whereas English copy, I'm generalizing hugely here, English copy can be a little bit more sort of leisurely and measured. Americans are a little bit more brash, and that also permeates the copy a little bit. But it was more about the personalities of the people that I, of the clients that I met. Like I just found, again, generalizing, but middle-class white American males, I had issues with them. I just found them very kind of preppy and, you know, a little bit narrow-minded and, you know, loved everybody else I met in New York, but the men in business that I met, not the women, the men in business I met, I just found them a little bit, not two-faced, but a bit, they had no irony button. So that, you know, I'd say, how was your weekend? And they'd say, oh, you're so forward. Like, so I'm just being, you know, so that was the main difference that I found.
And Philip, in closing, you are teaching, you are still working, you're still writing novels. What would you say to someone who's thinking about becoming a copywriter? What can they expect if they go for it? What kind of life can they expect?
Well, I say to my students, you know, if you can get into an agency, and even if your first job isn't as a copywriter, if you just get into an agency, like the job that you mentioned at Y&R, if you can just get in the door, if you're working in an agency, it's quite often, not always, it's quite often a pretty fun place filled with smart, interesting people, and you get interesting projects. And if you end up being a copywriter, you end up, as you know, becoming an instant expert in all sorts of things. So if you work on Sealy Posturepedic beds, you know all about springs and mattresses. You do the factory tour. If you work on Honda, you go to the, you know, the Honda factory. You might even travel overseas to see where the actual cars are made. You get to go into clients' offices, you get to go on excursions, you get to go to events, and you're getting paid for it. So it's a pretty good life. It's a pretty good, interesting life. And there aren't many downfalls in terms of the work itself. It's only that, you know, if you get, you know, a boss who's a bit difficult to get along with, or a client who's a bit difficult to get along with, but that's true of any industry. So I've had an absolute ball. And my advice is to try to be nice, because that old saying about you meet them on the way down, that is true. And you also find that you get much more work from existing clients, even if you haven't heard from them for 5 years. So often I get an email or a call saying, hey Philip, I run the time lapse photography company. Remember me? We've got a new website. Can you write that for us? I'm much more likely to get work from an old client than from a new client. You still got to try and get new clients, of course. But so just be nice, be professional. If you do some good work, try to get it out there so that people see it. But don't spend all of your time on LinkedIn and, you know. Yeah.
It sounds like a fantastic way to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time and wisdom and knowledge. It's been really wonderful to talk to you.
You too, Bernadette. Thank you so much.
As you can see, there's lots of ways to find the right people and get your foot in the door, even if the proverbial door doesn't exist anymore. The message I took from Philip was stay focused, keep trying, and never, ever give up. Someone has to get the work. Why not you? Speaking of getting paid what you're worth, I was at a job interview a few years ago and I asked, what's the starting salary? And they said, well, the starting salary is 50K, but you could expect that to increase to 75K next year. I said, well, in that case, I'll start next year. My quote for the day, because I know you're waiting for it. No matter how slow you're going, you're still lapping everyone on the couch. Never a truer word was spoken. Well, that's it from me. All the best and bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Copywriter. You'll find the show notes at soyouwanttobeacopywriter.com.au. This podcast was brought to you by the Australian Writer Centre. Do you want to get started as a professional copywriter? Have a look at our course, Copywriting Essentials. Created by Bernadette Schwert, this 5-week online course will teach you how to write words that sell and get paid to be creative. Find out more at writercentre.com.au/copywriting. And thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Copywriter. You'll find the show notes at soyouwanttobeacopywriter.com.au.